Recording in Los Gatos, California on January 18th, 2016. This is Geek Speak, episode 3 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, your host and producer of Geek Speak. With me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist, iOS developer, and a lifelong tinkerer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing, Lyle?
Quite well, thank you. We also have Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a teacher, traveler, and music geek.
What's up? Hey, music geek. Can I tell you what I'm going to do in, I think it's May?
Yeah.
The San Jose Symphony is putting on Titanic. Not Titanic the musical. There is a Titanic the musical.
You mean the movie?
It's not very good. Yeah. the movie, Titanic, the San Jose Symphony, and actually the San Francisco Symphony, I believe it is, have been putting on movies without the soundtrack, and then they play the soundtrack live on the stage.
Didn't you just see Indiana Jones?
I saw Indiana Jones on Friday. It was fantastic. That's a weird movie. I've seen snippets. I haven't seen the whole thing. That's a really weird movie.
That's so strange. I think of that movie as like canon. I'm surprised.
Oh, no,
maybe it's different generationally.
Yeah, it's definitely canon. It definitely has this ishness kind of on par with the original Star Wars and everything. But like,
it's kind of racist, probably, and you know, racist. Sexist. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, yeah, it's just weird.
Okay.
But the music. Amazing.
When you said the symphony was putting on the Titanic, the first thing that came to mind was the end of the Titanic when the quartet is sitting there playing as the ship goes down.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
I'm glad it wasn't that.
Yeah, the conductor will throw water balloons at them.
Yeah.
Where they go.
I did see Titanic the musical. Very interesting from a stage perspective. I know that you would enjoy it, Lyle, because you did theater as well.
Complicated stage?
Like when the ship sinks, they actually tilt the entire set.
Nice.
At like a 30 or 35 degree angle. People are sliding
down. Is it an opera or a musical?
It's a musical.
I hadn't heard that existed.
Yeah, I don't know if it should. It's okay.
Did they use some of the music that's known for, some of the pop music that's used in Titanic?
Celine Dion.
Celine Dion?
I don't think so. I don't
recall
that.
Was it extremely irritating to you when you saw it?
No.
Then probably it wasn't. Okay, that was just total dig. That was just mean. Hey, if you'd like to participate in Geek Speak, we welcome you to contact us online after you hear our show and you go, oh, they got that wrong, or here's some more information. You can contact us. We're KOSP Geeks on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus. I don't know how you find us, but we're there too. But also, you can just email us. We're geeks@geekspeak.org, like Grant did.
Yeah, you can email me and be annoyed with me for not loving Indiana Jones. But yeah, so Grant did. He corrected, or rather he, I guess, expanded a previous story that we did. I wasn't on the show when we did this, but we did a story about T-Mobile's Binge On service, which the idea behind it is T-Mobile's offering is supposed to help deliver an optimized video experience while using less data.
And in fact, when you sign on for their service, Binge On, the T-Mobile Binge On, if you're just watching video and stuff, you have unlimited data.
Yeah.
In that sense. So it's really cool if you watch a lot of YouTube and Netflix and so on, you get as much data as you possibly want.
Yeah, but we should put that in air quotes because it's not really unlimited data. It turns out what they're actually doing is they're just throttling. And the EFF, the guys, the people who sue the government when no one else will, right? I love them. I donate to them, and I have a couple of their awesome T-shirts, which involve unicorns. They did a test, and they confirmed that yes, indeed, the Binge On service is not optimization; it's throttling. So when you turn it on, they basically say, "Yeah, you can use as much data as you want, but we're just gonna make sure you don't use all that much data." And so, it's that's not so great.
How much do they throttle?
They throttle actually. What's the number? There's a graph here. I'll just try and explain the graph. It's about half of normal or even a little less. So like streaming in the browser, it looks like it's about a third of the bandwidth. Mm-hmm. If you're doing a direct download of a video, it's about half. A direct download of a non-video file, this is the weird thing, non-video file extension, the speed was a third with Binge On turned on as opposed to normal. And then direct non-video download is also a little bit lower. So
you're describing a speed. What, don't you mean bandwidth?
Bandwidth, yeah. That's a better way of putting it. So if you want to download a certain amount of data and you have Binge On turned on, it's going to take you twice or three times as long to download the same amount of bytes than normal.
Why are they calling that optimized? I mean, how does...
Because
how
marketing, does... it's a complete lie.
But if restricting the bandwidth to less speed, basically, equals, give something to the customer, how does that give something to the customer? If I download a movie that takes terabyte to download, it's going to take me a lot longer, but it's going to use the same amount of bandwidth. It just means I can't stream real time. So how does it help the customer?
So the idea is that you can use data without worrying about going over your data cap.
Well, wait a second. Video streaming has had to deal with this for a long time. So,
right.
So services out there that stream video have a way to adapt to different network conditions, right?
Yeah, and this is exactly this is what's so interesting about this. A lot of people are not going to notice the difference, even though they're being served lower quality video. And the reason is, if I go to YouTube and I try and watch a nice, beautiful HD video, and I'm watching this huge, huge video, if I have Binge On turned on, T-Mobile's thing, what's going to happen is YouTube is going to say, hey, you actually don't have as much bandwidth as you're supposed to. So we're going to give you a lower quality video stream so that way you won't get stutters like that,
okay.
Right?
So because they're throttling and then the video services detect the bandwidth usage and deliver an optimized video, assuming YouTube.
No, it's not an optimized video.
Well, it's just lower resolution.
Lower compression, whatever.
I guess if you make the assumption that the video streaming company is used to lower bandwidths and therefore optimizes their stream for that lower bandwidth, you could say it's optimized by that end.
No, because you also optimize for higher bandwidth too. So if you have a lot of bandwidth versus not so much bandwidth, both video streams are going to be optimized to squeeze as much quality, whatever quality means,
that's
into
video
that.
Encoding. Like, that's what
that's
you
video
do.
Encoding.
Right.
So there is no optimization going on one versus the other.
Right.
They're just saying, no, you can't use this. You know, we're going to throttle your
connection. I would say, though, that if I'm a user of a video service and I cannot get the big 1080p video file to actually play without it stuttering every few minutes, if instead it plays smoothly but it's lower quality video, that's kind of an optimization for that restricted data plan.
Right.
So it's marketing, definitely. But I get why it works in some ways, because on a small screen phone, you might not even notice they're talking about they're talking about 480p video on small screen. So the smaller the screen, technically, the quality could degrade it a little bit. I mean, I have an iPhone 6 Plus, so I can actually see 1080p on my phone, and I know the difference.
Yeah,
but that's a little different.
So I don't know. T-Mobile can deliver whatever services they want to the customers, but if they're going to claim it's optimization when it is absolutely not optimization, it is throttling. Like if they said, hey, we have this service called Throttle On, and we're going to throttle your connection, and it won't count towards your data cap. Fine. That's fine with me. At least you're being honest with the customers.
Or how about pay nothing for less video?
Right.
You know, let me just, I feel like since we're talking about this and I happen to know a lot about it, I should just put out a, what does it say when you, full disclosure?
Yeah, disclosure.
Yeah, full disclosure.
Full disclosure. I work for Netflix. I know a lot about video streaming, but that's not my profession at Netflix. I actually just do UI stuff. But one of the things that, so I just want to put that out there because I don't want to be skirting the issue. Just let's be clear. And so therefore, there might be stuff I can't say about it, and that's fine.
Sure.
But one thing I noticed about this is that all the video stuff they used in this test, they used HTTP, which would allow the carrier T-Mobile to detect what files were being transferred.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not using secure, they could detect it. And they did one that was a non-video file, and the non-video file was not throttled the same level as the video files. But it was still
throttled.
I would say it was affected. And what I'm reading here is that we only saw a small drop on the non-video file from Binge versus normal, and that small drop might be the processing to figuring out if it is a video file or not.
That's a big drop. That's like a 15-20% drop.
Look at the Binge On video file throughput. It's 1.2 megabits per second, yeah. period. You do not 1.5 megabits per second. It does not get above that. But the direct download video, non-video file is up at 4.2. So there's definitely a difference. I bet it's just the overhead of their system.
Yeah.
So they're looking at everything. I'm really curious, and why did EFF didn't do this? Why not handle HTTPS? Because you definitely, if you did that, they might not know, and they might have to throttle all of it.
HTTPS being an encrypted connection, so that way your ESP, T-Mobile, can't look at the traffic and say, oh, this is a video and this is not a video.
Yeah. I think the other thing that would concern me about this is that though it works for the companies that do video service, because the video service company then downgrades the video and you still get video, it wouldn't work for me putting up video files on geekspeak.org.
Absolutely.
Those video files wouldn't, there'd only be one option. I wouldn't.
And the reason is like you're not going to encode I don't know. You're kind of obsessed. Maybe you might.
I do that.
Yeah. You might not, as just a webmaster of a simple website, you might not decide, I'm going to make 5 versions of this video so that way all the different people with all the different devices are going to be able to access it. You might just say, oh, I'm just going to export this, or I'm going to put it online. Okay, I'm done.
More than that, I might upload multiple versions, but then I have to surface to the user the choice of which one they have to choose.
It's not the simplest.
And they have to know what kind of bandwidth they have to choose. So it just becomes this big problem.
So this doesn't work so well. This works fine when you're looking at YouTube or Vimeo or something like that, a service like that, which has all of these mechanisms in place to bump you up to a higher resolution or down to a lower resolution, depending on the way your connection is responding.
When the story was first talked about, we talked about possibly that T-Mobile was, this was slightly not, it was kind of anti-
Net neutrality.
Net neutrality. Thank you.
Yeah, because you were saying video content is treated differently than non-video content.
Or more than that, that they had partners and only the partners were getting this kind of service. But it looks like it's everybody.
Well, yeah. That was part of the marketing that created all the confusion, is talking about there was partners, and obviously that implies non-partners.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I would assume that T-Mobile would definitely want to talk to the big companies, like, we're planning on doing this to get buy-in. So it makes sense that there'd be communication at some level, but the small shops wouldn't necessarily have that. But more, the barrier to entry would be implementing an auto detection feature where you could offer multiple streams, which any video service company that's going to start up would probably implement that anyway, so they'd be able to participate on this. Mm. But the other aspect of this was that for a little while we thought maybe T-Mobile was re-encoding video. They're not doing that. They're not modifying the files at all. They're just throttling. So there you go.
If you want more information or you really like video discussion, check out the EFF's article on this. It's up on geekspeak.org.
I thought you were going to say if you really like unicorn shirts.
Oh, yeah, then you can donate to the EFF and get a unicorn shirt, just like me.
Thank you, Ben, for the follow-up on a story. You weren't even there for the original.
Right.
That is a pro, man.
That was kind of weird.
You were on it. Hey, Brian, what's going on with Tim Cook?
Oh, well, so let's talk about encryption. Let's talk about backdoors, and let's talk about how we're in the political season now. So there's a lot of discussion going on, I understand, in the Democratic debate last night.
I have a story actually that kind of sets up your story quite well, which is that at the Democratic presidential debate last night, and of course we're recording on Monday, so this was Sunday, January 17th, Marquez Brownlee asked the candidates a question about whether or not the government should require tech companies to implement backdoors in their encryption. Now, techies or web developers, systems engineers, we all go, oh, that's horrible. Of course, definitely no. But it's not necessarily evident why not to the layman or the presidential candidate or even someone who's moderately well-versed on technical issues. So the idea is, if the government wants to, do anti-terrorism things, right, then they should be able to investigate traffic going through, Facebook or WhatsApp or Netflix or Apple services or Google services. The way that they can do that, if those services are encrypted, is by communicating with those companies and forcing them to put a backdoor in. So they can go in that backdoor, look at all the information and the data, maybe do their anti-terrorist stuff, hopefully not do anything else. Of course.
I mean, the truth is that this has been tapping phone companies for years have allowed this by a court order. It's very, it's a very normalized process. Somebody somebody, investigator writes up something, gives it to a judge. Judge says, yes, I approve of that. You take it to AT&T. You say, AT&T, I want to listen to Ben's phone line at home. Here's the court order. AT&T gives the police a tap. They listen.
Right.
And that,
so there's a process.
And pretty much all of us support that idea because we want to have a check and balance against police powers.
Right.
But when we have a communication pattern that's encrypted, that gets much more complicated because AT&T might not be able to look at that data.
Yeah, they may not even, they may be designing systems where they can't even look at the data that their users are sending back and forth.
Because of encryption math.
Yeah, they're a network and the encryption math makes it impossible.
So did the candidates answer this well to your liking?
No, of course not. Of course not. And actually, just to finish my thought, if you put a backdoor into somewhere for, let's say, the government to go in, that means that you need to trust not only that the government is well-intentioned, but that the government is secure and that your backdoor is secure.
Well, let's talk about, well, finish that thought.
Oh, yeah.
Because I want to talk about what a backdoor means.
Yeah, yeah. So if it's not, that means that people who, let's talk about what a backdoor means.
Okay. So when people talk about backdoors, I think sometimes people just think about something being broken. Like there's a broken window somebody's slipping into. In the mathematical sense for encryption, it would be like leaving this one key word that if the algorithm ever sees it, it lets it wide open and then people can get in there and break the door and get in.
Yeah.
I think it might be more clear to say encryption is based on keys. Somebody has a secret. And if they have that secret, they can decode the message.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So what this really is talking about giving somebody else the keys. So there's two sets of keys, two different keys.
Right.
And so I might have the key to be able to read your message, but somebody else has to have that key. And all of a sudden, you're trusting two parties. Well, really,
right.
Three, person who sent it.
So I have the keys to see my messages. Let's say you're the government. Gmail or whoever gives you the keys to see my messages. The problem, the thing that makes this even worse is that it's not a set of physical keys that if they disappear, you know that they're gone.
It's a really large number.
It's a really large number. If anyone gets that secret code, it's kind of like a password. If anyone else gets that password, either by hacking your systems, by a data leak, by a disgruntled employee, any of those possible things, which are all very feasible, then that other third party, the nefarious party, can now read all of my messages through that same quote-unquote backdoor,
yeah,
which is that secret key that
When we talk about encryption, that is a really, I mean, to really break it down, if you and I, Ben, are going to communicate with encryption, we can just basically think of that I can mix things up that only your key can read, and you can mix things up that only my key can read.
Right.
And that is like a mathematical rule of the universe if we do it correctly.
So that means I can send messages to you can send messages to me, but Brian cannot
see it.
Cannot read them.
And that's the kind of technology that's being implemented most of the time now because it's very clear that information is being looked upon all the time. And so that's the way people are producing it. But that means that if Apple makes Messenger, which is like one of the ones we're talking about, the messaging service that's available on the iPhones and iOS devices, when they make that, they set up the application such that it does exactly that. It makes me and Ben have a tunnel that nobody else can look at.
Well, right.
And therefore, when the governance gives an order to Tim Cook's company and says, hey, Ben's been devious. Here's a court order. Here's a judge signature and everything. Apple just says, I'm sorry. I cannot help you. It just... I don't have the ability to look into it.
Yeah, right? no one can decode it other than you and I.
That's actually an interesting example because that is a case where since you don't have the keys in iMessage and Ben doesn't have the keys in iMessage, somehow those keys are exchanged somewhere.
So this is the really tricky part technically Apple could do something in response.
Yeah. And the reason why this is all important is because you have to trust somebody to manage the keys if you're not managing them yourself. So if you're going to trust a third party to hold some keys to look at that conversation so that maybe a court order would allow somebody to look at that conversation, somebody has to hold those keys and you have to be able to trust that somebody. And in this age where we see the hacking that happens to major corporations and governments all the time and sensitive data is getting out all the time, who can you trust to hold those keys until the court order is issued?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting. And I think we're going to continue this conversation a little bit.
Definitely.
Just wrap this. Stay with us. You're listening to GeekSpeak. You can email us, geeks@geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, Ben Jaffe, and Brian Young. We'll be right back. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me is Ben Jaffe and Brian Young. We're going to talk a lot of things about a lot of things today, but we're talking about encryption and keys and backdoors because it's in debate in politics, and people aren't really covering it very well.
Right. So when we left off, I was having a conversation with you, Lyle. You were having a conversation with me.
Via our phones.
We have this secret tunnel. I have the keys to read your messages. You have the keys to read our my messages. But we kind of made this realization that, no, actually, I don't have the keys. You don't have the keys. Our phones have the keys.
That's right.
And let's say that we both have iPhones. That means that Apple actually has the ability to manage, is managing those keys for us.
In fact, the very first time, if you had an Apple device and you and I were texting each other, the first time I put your phone number in my phone to send a text message to you, what actually happens is it goes to Apple. Apple looks at it and goes, oh, this phone number is Ben Jaffe, and Ben Jaffe already has Messenger set up, and he has a private key, and his phone has his phone has a private key, but I have the public key of Ben. So then it takes my message, or it sends back to my phone the public part of you, the representation of you, and then I encrypt with yours. So that key exchange happened through Apple. And there is where you potentially could say, you know what, why don't we just have Apple has the major keys and have the ability to encrypt and decrypt everything, and then they could answer a subpoena from the court.
Right.
And the problem with that, of course, is that then Apple can look at it. And not just because a court order happened, not some kind of magical, wow, legally it's available. No, they'd put it in the system and it would be available. There'd be a system in their company that would allow this to happen. And therefore, vulnerabilities, concerns, all of those things can emerge.
Right. Yeah. And it's even worse if you, the company, Apple, for example, doesn't just have the system, but you give access to other entities like the government, and maybe the government gives access to third-party contractors, or maybe the government gets hacked by another government or by another entity. It can get really nasty really fast, and you can't just undo that kind of damage trivially.
So here's what's really interesting. The math to do this is really well known.
Yes.
In fact, there is libraries on the internet that any well-meaning developer could go and use and implement fairly easily. Really strong encryption to communicate between two people.
In fact, a lot of people have already developed that software.
Yeah.
Outside of Apple.
There's plenty of them. I have several on my phone. And in fact, there's one that I generate the keys on my phone, and through a QR code or a camera, I share that with somebody else's phone, and no key exchange, no third-party key exchange goes on. I'm directly sharing the public key with somebody, and they're directly sharing the public key with me, and there is no possible way that anybody can get in between that conversation and read it.
And the way that would work would be like Ben and I see each other whenever we record Geek Speak and he's on. And therefore, at that time, I'd look at him and I'm like, that's Ben. And he'd look at me and that's Lyle. And we'd take out our phones and we'd have them talk to each other for a second. And no other outside resource would have it. And therefore, even though that traffic went through many carriers and all of that, they would not be able to look at it, read it, or alter it without us knowing about it. It's pretty amazing.
Assuming that our phone vendors are cooperating.
Well, assuming there's no software on the phone that's subverting that.
Absolutely. And this is actually kind of getting back to the political side of this. They're asking people at the... Oh, you had some... Yeah. They were asking the presidential candidates at the Democratic debates about this, and they were saying, like, how do you feel about encryption? And they were pretty wishy-washy about it. They were not very clear. Actually, one very interesting thing happened. So I'll just read this little snippet from the slash dot snippet. But the most interesting comment came from Hillary Clinton after mentioning that the Obama administration officials had, quote, started the conversation with tech companies on the encryption issue. One of the moderators noted that the government, quote, got nowhere with its requests. Clinton replied, that's not what I've heard. Let me leave it at that.
Interesting.
And either she was covering her butt in the debate because she just said the opposite, or she knows something.
So here's the thing that I find as a optimistic technologist and everything.
Yeah.
The world, the mathematical rules of the universe happen to be that it's extremely easy to make stuff private. Period.
Yeah.
You can do secrets really, really easily. I mean, when I say really, really easily, it's anybody's computer, any computer can do this kind of encryption. It's not a big deal. In fact, you can do it by hand. It would take you a friggin' long time.
Yeah.
But it's big not numbers. Like this is magic. This is complicated math, but not outside the scope of millions of people. Like, there's a million people on the planet that know how to do this, right? So you can't keep it a secret. It's a fundamental aspect of the universe. Mm-hmm. So why fight that? Like, you have to accept that people can communicate privately together. It's just going to happen.
Well, and I want to continue that because let's say somehow there was a law passed that said that a company had to hold another set of keys that could decrypt every message that was using their software, or the government held the keys.
Sure.
Let's say that was passed. Let's say all of the consumer software that was sold on the app stores
legally
and legally sold had these extra keys, these back doors. Even if that was true, even if this was completely managed, the papers have been published, the libraries exist. Mm-hmm. Anybody with just some level of technical sophistication can go out and make an app that can't be broken into by these other systems because the keys won't be a part of that.
I mean, what if that becomes illegal? I mean, that's kind of the heart of this is like...
You can make something illegal to sell. Can you make something illegal to know? This is knowledge.
Well, but it only works if you make a system that enough people who are not one of those millions of people who know how to do it use. Right. So like the reason that Lyle and I can talk encrypted, or that you and I, Brian, can talk encrypted through our computers, through our phones, is that our phones and our computers have software that we both use that know how to talk to each other and do this particular encryption, right? If my operating system of my computer or my phone was legally obligated to not allow me to easily do that, I probably wouldn't.
Right. I probably wouldn't write my own software to do this kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
My secrets are not that meaningful to me. At the same time, the people that you're trying to spy upon don't have that feeling, right? Like,
right.
The reason you want to look at someone and get a court order to look at something because you think they're breaking the law in other ways. And mm-hmm. therefore, those people, assuming they're intelligent and good at what they do, will install this harder-to-use software that's illegal. But the other point about that, though, is that we see time and time again in terrorist attacks and things of that nature that there's normally a digital trail because they're not using that type of technology,
right.
Even though it exists.
Right.
So you could the back and forth about that has to do with an arms race and a practicality.
Yeah.
What I don't like, though, is if you enforce this, you will have accidental or mistaken leaks.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's the problem for me, is that you can't implement this with full trust. We keep on saying, well, you know, if somebody had a system that was really good that could interspace and hold these private keys and do a good job of that.
Was hack-proof.
Where does that exist?
Nothing
where
is hack-proof.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't, it's not going to really work.
Yeah.
Well, and let's take this to one more level. We're a democracy. I mean, what is important
we're
about...
Representative democracy.
We're representative democracy. What's important about encryption in democracy? This is a new thing in that it's only been the last 50 years that we've had this kind of encryption that has been introduced into our society. But we've dealt with privacy in our society for much longer than that.
Yes.
Right.
And yeah. Now that we have encryption... Now that we have this way to keep secrets, and now the government wants to have its reason, it has its reasons to get in the way of that so that it's not completely secret. All of a sudden, we're in a society where the government can reach in and try to find out your thoughts. Now, 50 years ago, that wasn't a problem because that meant tapping into a telephone line and listening to a conversation.
Or bugging someone's house.
But
something.
Now we right. have systems that the NSA has worked on that we know exist that have been able to record massive amounts of data and go back and retroactively look at something you said and if they can break that encryption.
Right.
So... In a world where we can't trust that something that we say is private, all of a sudden we may start censoring our thoughts so that we don't get branded as some sort of terrorist or branded right. as some sort of child pornographer or branded as something that could be misinterpreted.
Yeah. One interesting way that I like to think about this, because, you know, the whole everything I do online, everyone I talk to and everything could be monitored, that's very, very abstract, right? But if you take this out of the digital realm and you imagine it in more of an analog realm, it feels Orwellian. If you imagine that everywhere you went, there was a microphone, including within the comfort of your own house, you know, like you guys come over, sit in my living room, we have a conversation. Clearly that feels like it should be completely private. Nobody else should listen in. I haven't mm-hmm. invited the government to listen. But this is almost like saying the whole idea of wiretapping and encryption backdoors and all of this feels almost like the analog version of them putting a microphone everywhere, including in your living room,
right.
in your bedroom, in your bathroom,
and that's
and recording
more,
everything.
That's because more and more of what your communication is and what you represent your local circle is not geographically local.
Right.
It's all over the place.
Right.
So you have very close friends across the planet and you're talking to them all the time. So that's very akin to having a small town going down the street. and people listening to you all the time. It's creepy. And it just has to do with where our boundaries of what we consider private, how they're no longer geographical. And the phone did that at first, but it's happened much more so. And the more we move in that world, the more it feels like an invasion. And let me just talk about, you're touching upon something that I just love this idea, and it's really at the core of this. And that has to do with what privacy really is and what it means and why it what it holds to you as an individual. And I think if you really start thinking about what privacy is, you start realizing that it's actually kind of part of the human psyche. It's an important aspect of being human, is to have something private. I mean, a perfect example, and it's not secret. Secrets and privacies are not the same thing.
Right, right, absolutely.
I mean, that great example of that is that it's not a secret what you do in the bathroom, but it's private what you do in the bathroom, right? Like, everyone knows what you did. But
right.
No one, you know, you have a place, you have an area where you're safe to be doing something that you don't want other people to witness. That's
right.
All it is.
Absolutely.
And I think if you put everybody in a place where they do not have that privacy, it's psychologically damaging to them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a good response to, well, I have nothing to hide, you know?
Right.
Well, if you have nothing to hide, then surely you don't mind the government bugging every room in your house. Well, actually, for some reason, that feels really creepy.
It feels wrong about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Something feels completely wrong. And maybe that's because it's encroaching upon a physical space, and we're evolutionarily predisposed to think of physical spaces, but we're not evolutionarily predisposed to think about and understand digital spaces.
And to sum something up here, yes, encryption is new, and we've had wiretapping for as long as we've had telephones.
Right.
But while encryption is new and something very difficult for the governments and police to deal with, governments and police also have capacities to monitor us that they never had before as well.
True.
And that's new.
Mm-hmm.
So these are things that have to stay in balance if our society is going to maintain that level of privacy that we need in order to be a functioning democracy.
Yeah. And society is decentralized. That's one more thing I'd add to your bullet list.
Right.
So many things are changing, and that's another thing.
You know, there's another aspect of this that, you know, other police powers that have grown, and that is the surveillance of the general public space. Like, you know, we're not currently debating whether all the cameras in London should be fed back into a system and have facial detection systems and all those things. In some ways, I'm less offended by that because that is a public space versus private communications being potentially tapped. But, you know, keep in mind that I'm totally for warrants where an intelligent group of people ask a judge, and the judge looks at it and weighs the cons of the society's right for privacy and the society's right for safety, and decides in the favor of tapping someone's communication. I support that. Technically, you can't do it without having other consequences, which I think are worse. And that's why I don't support this backdoor. It's like, it's not about being able to do it. I think we should be able to do it. Just because the way the universe is structured, you can't do it safely. That's the problem.
Yep. Yeah.
Unless you have extreme trust in some entity that keeps it safe.
Which,
I don't think anyone has that, really.
I mean, even if you have extreme trust in some entity, you can't possibly know that that entity will keep it safe.
Did we talk about the Tim Cook story?
We never actually got back to Tim Cook.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. What did Tim Cook have to say?
The reason why I was hesitant
Tim
talking...
Cook is the CEO of Apple, by the way.
Yes, yes. And the reason why I was hesitant talking about that when you first handed the baton over to me was that fact that we had to really describe what the issue with encryption is to understand Tim Cook's frustration. There's an article talking about how he feels that the Obama administration is being too wishy-washy about declaring definitively that there should not be any backdoors prescribed for encryption. And this discussion just illustrates why he might be frustrated about that. The interesting thing to me is that he is, so far as I can see, the only major tech company CEO or executive that's speaking out about encryption right now.
Right.
There are obviously interests in Google and many other large companies about this, but Tim Cook is of course, Apple has marketing that is related to saying that they're more private than other companies, but so he has an incentive there to talk about it. But still, a single CEO talking about this important societal issue is interesting to me that nobody else is doing that.
Yeah, yeah. Ben, I feel like we should do some space news, actually, because we
space news.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, this is a short one. SpaceX has been launching these rockets and also attempting to land them so that way they can be reused.
We covered a successful landing.
That was fantastic. And then they took that rocket that they successfully landed and did a static test of it.
Good.
And it seemed to work fine. So just on on Sunday, January 17th, I think it was. They successfully launched their Falcon 9 rocket. Carrying this ocean monitoring satellite. So that's a good success. They're still very good at getting things up into space. Uh-huh. And then they had, I think it's fun to call this a partial success of the rocket landing.
They safely landed the rocket. I saw the video.
So yeah, like,
and but, then it fell over.
Right.
And so exploded.
Like, what does a partial success mean? It feels like a rocket landing is either successful or it's completely catastrophic and the rocket explodes. That's what happened in this case. The rocket had kind of a hard landing. Apparently, one of the clamps or latches failed to latch or clamp properly, and it slowly toppled over, landed on its side, and exploded in a huge fiery ball of flame.
So did they declare that it was from a hard landing? I didn't see that part.
At first, they did. It said they first said it looks like a hard landing broke the landing leg. But then they said root cause. Oh, yeah. It said this is the tweet. I think it was Falcon lands on drone ship, but the lockout collet doesn't latch on one of the four legs, causing it to tip over post landing. Root cause may have been ice buildup due to condensation from heavy fog at liftoff. So, you know, like, so web development is interesting because...
What? Wait, non-sequitur.
Because you build an application and you're like, okay, I think I got it right. And you hit run and you test it and nothing works. It effectively explodes. And you go back and you do it again and you keep going with that cycle again and again and again. And that's like every day for me and for you and for you. Going to space and doing rocketry is not like that. If your rocket explodes, that's like tens of millions of dollars down the drain. So you have to get everything right. It's really hard to get everything right. It's complicated. It's rocket science. So anyway, of course, best wishes to them. And I am excited to see their next attempt.
I think it's fascinating that it looks like a video game when it lands and then it goes and it falls over and then it explodes. The video is great. It'll be up on geekspeak.org.
Yep.
All right, Brian, we haven't talked about digital currency in a while, so let's talk about Bitcoin, shall we?
Yeah, so I'm not a Bitcoin expert, and this is going to go into a bunch of topics that I don't want to claim to be an expert on.
Right, but, yeah, none of us.
None of us. But Bitcoin has been a really interesting story over the years now. Does either of you have Bitcoin?
I, at one point, got a little bit, but very little, and I don't remember where the keys are.
Oh, no. Well, that's the problem with having keys that are not physical.
It might be on my Windows machine. There might be like some, you know, I haven't booted that in a couple of years. So.
Yeah. So I heard about this from a friend of mine saying that years ago he bought some Bitcoin as a test and then he sold it when it reached $30. Of course.
And then it got up to what, $12.80?
Well, it crashed after that down to $1. And then it goes up, and that's the history of Bitcoin. It goes up, it goes down in these big crashes. And right now it's hovering at the $300 or $400 a Bitcoin mark.
Small correction. I don't think it crashed down to $1 after the $12.80, but it was at $1.
Oh,
before.
You're right. I am remembering.
It crashed down to what, like 200 or 160 or something like that.
Well, no, anyway, I'm going further back. So it has a sordid history, and now there is more history to go into. But what I find really fascinating is this started out where Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever this man was,
pseudonymous person,
or multiple people, as people have tried to figure out. He created this currency, this digital currency out of math, as a way to have a form of money that the governments can't manipulate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Secure and decentralized.
Exactly. Well, that was the goal, at least.
Right.
But the whole idea of it being decentralized has been a little shaky lately. Politically, there's a lot of stuff going on within the Bitcoin community that happens because so many people have mined it and amassed such a large percentage of Bitcoin among just a few people that it's become much less decentralized. And it's actually control is slipping into the hands of fewer and fewer people.
Yeah. So the idea behind the decentralization is that you have all of these different computers all around the world doing complex math to quote unquote mine Bitcoin. And this is not a physical thing. This is a totally digital thing. So they're all working to mine Bitcoin. They win little Bitcoin pieces here and there, and then they can, of course, exchange that for dollars or yen or whatever it is, or hold on to it. But the math that they're doing to mine the Bitcoin also guarantees the security of the network itself. And because math, I mean, that's how that's as far as we'll get into it now.
We but could
because,
definitely dive deep into this if you want. But yeah.
So because math, it's this decentralized thing that thousands of people are all doing the thing.
And we're going to talk more about this in just a minute here on GeekSpeak. And I trust me, it's fascinating stuff. We'll be right back. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Trox. I'm talking with Ben Jaffe and Brian Young. Bitcoin, one of the other things about this decentralized thing that Ben was talking about is all these servers actually have a full history of all transactions and actually kind of wrap up kind of like summaries like you would your once a month balance of your checkbook. All these servers can do them. The first person that actually finds a coin or does a anytime you do a transaction, including finding these numbers, you submit it, you sign it, and then you submit it to all these servers. And as these servers all look at it, they confirm that you found it, your number is valid, and then they kind of add that to their what's called the blockchain. And so it's basically like a distributed, but everybody has the same collection of things and mathematically proven that everybody still has the same collection.
Right. That's so everybody verifies each other's transactions. And if some nefarious bad actor comes in, they're just one in tens or hundreds of thousands of computers. So they're not going to be able to say, I actually have a million Bitcoins or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, but that means that that same blockchain needs to be transferred from each computer to the other. And
yep.
And as it grows, all those transactions grow, it gets larger and larger.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they've run into some problems because of that. And there's been debates within the community that maybe they shouldn't keep the entire blockchain. They should cap it off at a certain limit. This has created some technical problems. And I don't want to try to go into the full details because there's a lot of community fighting going on. That what I want to raise to everyone's attention is, first of all, if you did go out and dabble in Bitcoin, you should probably take a look and try to dig into some of these things to see if your money has any value to you and what you want to do about it.
But to see if you want to pull out of it.
But the reason why the blockchain is so interesting is this math, the way this works, it not only does it create this verifiable trail, but it also creates something that's digital, that's infinitely reproducible. It actually creates a scarcity in it. It makes it so that this thing is not copyable. And people are starting to use the blockchain for things like copy protection on music and other items. I see you furrowing your brow there.
How would you take advantage of the blockchain to do this? Oh, I see. So
math,
what you could
math,
do
math.
Is potentially you could use this by signing something and then putting part of that signature back into the blockchain signature or system.
Which verifies that.
And timestamps it and everybody gets a copy of it. So basically like date stamping stuff with the blockchain.
So you're almost kind of using like the blockchain for storage of your own data in a way.
Is that kind of how it works?
I believe so. And
interesting.
On the technical level, I'm going to have to skirt over that.
I think let's skirt over that because big maths.
Yeah. Wait, this is only a one-hour show, right?
Yeah, Bitcoin is such a huge topic. But this is really awe-inspiring tech, the way the blockchain is able to allow these things. But bring it back to Bitcoin itself. Since they're having problems with trying to determine whether the blockchain should include every transaction or whether it should be limited at some point, it's actually created a strain on the Bitcoin technical system.
Yeah.
There's a transaction time that it takes for the blockchain to be updated and for it to be transferred to the Bitcoin servers. And technically, the way it's implemented now, it's actually becoming a longer and longer transaction time.
Mm.
So the Bitcoin community said, okay, well, in order to have fewer transactions so that we don't have to wait so long, we're just going to up our fees on the cost between transferring.
Oh, right, of course.
And so, one of the things that Bitcoin promised was very, very, very low fees.
Yes.
That's why it's better than a credit card or whatever. Mm-hmm. So if the fees go up, that's not so good.
So this has all created a lot of turmoil, and people are trying to get out of this turmoil. But all of the decisions on what a Bitcoin server is are made by these five original programmers that were handed the code by Satoshi Nakamoto. So,
or were actually the ones that wrote the code, yeah, since we don't really know.
Since we don't really know. and it's really fascinating that this decentralized open source system has fallen back into something that's highly controlled and centralized by a few people. And so as an experiment, some people are saying that maybe Bitcoin has failed, but it's this fascinating thing that I wish there was a better resolution, and I hope they can find a way out of this.
Well, you know, it is the first real success at a trial of this kind of magnitude.
Cryptocurrency, yeah.
So even if it fails, it's succeeded in a lot of ways, right? And I don't think it's going to necessarily fail. It's very possible these people will figure out that they've got to get the system more robust. It seems like because of its success, it's gotten so large and unwieldy, you have to have another technical problems. That's not, in normal parlance, that wouldn't be a failure, right? This massive success has caused other potential problems. I mean, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And I think that there's probably solvable, but the centralizing around five different core people seem a little
bad. So like the idea of a decentralized thing is that you've got a lot of different players, all of whom own a very small sliver of the network.
Yeah.
Another problem is that a relatively few number of people own massive amounts of computers, and they all kind of sum up to a large portion of the network.
That actually created another technical limitation. A lot of those are in China because China happens to have some
cheap electricity.
Mm-hmm. And apparently the Chinese firewall is getting in the way
because
so much of the data has to go through the Chinese firewall, and it's so slow from all of the monitoring that goes on that it's getting in the way of the network acting efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then you've also got the not so decentralized nature of there being five core programmers. And that's...
You know, I got to say, Ben, one thing about Bitcoin that was true in the early days is that you could mine Bitcoin. You can do there's all this idea of like finding the numbers by brute algorithmic force.
Right.
That is a bit of the industry, I would say, but just like you mine for gold still too. But the mining of gold does not affect the economy it affects economies in some areas where there's gold, but it's not like the major reason why the U.S. economy works is because we mine for gold. Just like the major reason why the Bitcoin economy works is not because we mine for Bitcoin. Like, that is now a very small piece of what Bitcoin is.
Right.
Mostly it's the transactional level stuff at this level, because there's so much out there. And it was always designed to slowly get less and less Bitcoin off the algorithm. So
that's true, except for the people that mined it collected so much.
They just got a lot in the beginning.
Among just a very few.
Right, right. It's really that it wasn't started... distributed right away by a million people doing it. Then it would be distributed by a million people. Just that happened to be that early on, there were only a few people.
So if somebody's going to make this again, if somebody's going to try this again, they have to have an incentive for people to start mining massively in the beginning.
Yeah, very cool. Well, should we get into the A-B test or wait for a longer, because we only have another 10 minutes or so. We got a couple stories.
Let's do some stories and see what happens.
Let's do A-B tests in the future. I promise you we'll talk about A-B tests because it's a fascinating subject and we'll cover it very well in a full show. But let's go ahead and talk about just a story of a computer sitting there. Have you listened to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or read the book that's based off of the radio show?
I did a long time ago.
So there's a robot that lives for the duration of the universe. And he's kind of a depressed robot.
Oh, yeah.
And this story of yours kind of reminds me of just this poor, sad robot sitting in a corner.
Right, yeah.
Doing its job.
There's a story at the register. It's just kind of a fun story, but it's a story on a post in a semi-private mailing list made by this guy. And he said, just switched off our longest-running server.
Okay.
Built and brought into service in early 1997...
And just this year, just turned it off?
Uh-huh. Has been running 24/7 for 18 years and 10 months.
Whoa.
This server did not get powered down.
It did not get rebooted.
Oh, yeah. It just ran.
What was it running?
This box was almost old enough to drink.
18?
Yeah. It's a 200 megahertz Pentium. 32 megs of RAM, 4 gigabytes SCSI 2 drive. So,
wow.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those were great specs in 97.
Well, and you know, SCSI drives probably means it's, you know, server level hardware.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not consumer level.
A hard drive running for 18 years is maybe the biggest part of that story. That's just
hard drive and a fan. The fans are also one of the first things to go.
You can change a fan out though while it's running.
They didn't change any parts.
Whoa.
Including the fans. 18 years. It was running FreeBSD 2.2.1.
Wait, how, like, fridges don't last long. Well, that's actually kind of harder. I mean, I'm saying other things. I mean, alarm clocks have definitely had alarm clock that's lasted that long. I mean, but that's a long time for a piece of electronics not to restart.
Yeah. So this is kind of a perfect storm, if you will, because normally if you have a machine and you wait 3 months, then you've got some security updates to do. You know,
yeah,
you've got
sure.
some real updates that you really, really should do. Maybe you want to update the operating system, any of this stuff. This particular server lived for so long because it was heavily firewalled. It was internal to a company.
Mm-hmm.
It had some very special software that was running. And if they tried to update the OS, I think as they did on a similar box, everything broke.
Yeah.
They had very little incentive to upgrade this. It just sat around and collected user session.
What was the operating system?
FreeBSD.
Yeah, okay. See, I can't imagine it happening on a Windows machine because a complicated user interface machine normally has memory leaks. Like, that's just kind of one of the things that emerges.
True.
So your machine kind of needs to be rebooted every once in a while. It just, unfortunately, because of bugs.
So what did it do? It just sat around in this internal network for 18 years, 19 years almost.
But did it have a task?
Collected user session and connection data summaries.
Okay.
Held copies of invoices, generated warning messages about data and call usages, rates and actual data against limits, and let them do real-time account inquiries,
cool.
et cetera. Yeah.
Marvin, by the way, is the depressed robot.
Marvin?
Yeah, Marvin.
Also,
the paranoid android.
The paranoid android. Mm-hmm. The other thing is they used 24-volt case-style fans with really good bearings, but they were running on a 12-volt rail.
So they last
So they had a fan that was much larger, but it was running much more slowly. So it ran more slowly, it ran more quietly, it didn't wear as easily, and it still moved enough air. So, yeah.
That's awesome. FreeBSD, by the way, is a cousin to the OS X operating system because OS X was created, I think, on top of BSD.
Right? Is it free?
Well, no, not on FreeBSD, but on BSD.
No, but is FreeBSD free?
FreeBSD means free as in free software.
Okay.
So, yeah, if you want to know more about that, that's a larger topic. free as in,
is it free? Respect? Free as in beer? Or free as in, wow, what's the two?
Free as in rights.
Free as in rights, not free as in... I can't...
We're doing a bad job of this. There's a great episode, actually, of Geek Speak where we had...
Richard Stallman.
Richard Stallman, the founder of that concept on Geek
and
Speak.
And his glorious beard. Man. That guy's intense.
Yeah, definitely.
So, did you hear about the new light bulb?
The MIT light bulb?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So,
but not everybody has. Tell.
You've got your cool LED light bulbs now.
By the way, the Richard Stallman show on free software is on 2008, February 2nd, 2008. So just around the corner years ago. 2008. So you can see the episode. You can listen to the episode at Geek Speak. You can subscribe to the podcast. Listen to the whole thing. Richard Stallman's a kick. Anyway, new light bulb, MIT research. Go.
Yeah. So you've got your cool LED light bulbs, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So they got a new bulb. It's really cool tech. You know what it is?
A new LED?
No, incandescent. Incandescent is back, baby.
Wait, what? No.
Black body radiation. Let's go.
Yeah. So MIT researchers have been coming up with trying to find more efficient lighting. And they built this new light bulb. It's totally in research. It's not anything production ready. We're not going to see these next year. But it is a regular incandescent filament. Only they sheath the filament in a special kind of glass that reflects all the heat back into the filament. So all the light gets out, but the heat goes back into the filament, creating more light. The biggest problem with light bulbs, with all kinds of light bulbs, is the heat that's generated and that's energy that's lost.
Wasted if you're planning on seeing. but not if you're planning on heating your house.
Right. So. Who heats their house with? Well, I guess people do heat their bathrooms with light
bulbs. I always think of light bulbs. You know, the Easy Bake Oven? That was powered by a light bulb. You could cook food under it.
Yeah. I think that was like 40 watts.
Yeah.
So just imagine this, an incandescent bulb that is potentially up to 40% efficient, which let's back up a little bit. Your regular incandescent light bulb in your house right now, if you have any of those left.
If you have them left, yeah. If you can buy them on the street.
Okay. Are any, is the store?
You can buy them. Yeah,
you can still buy them? Yeah, sure. Because I know the date's coming up soon where you can't buy them anymore.
Yeah.
Those old ones are running at about 5% efficiency. So this is massively more efficient.
10x almost.
Yeah. And the LEDs and fluorescent bulbs, the ones that we can buy at the store at a practical level are down around the 15 to 18% mark. So this is a huge leap in efficiency. And the great thing about incandescent bulbs, black body radiation, the great thing about this is it emits a lot of different spectrum of light. In other words, to our eyes, it looks much more pleasing and some people argue whiter light. Of course, tungsten, which is incandescent bulbs, if you take a photo with a film, you'll see it's much more orange, but still it's more pleasing light to most people than certainly fluorescent and even many LED bulbs.
It's called black body radiation because when you heat up a body hotter and hotter and hotter, it'll get to a dark red, if you've ever pounded steel or seen a blacksmith, you know how it glows. Mm-hmm. That's glowing because it's hot enough that there's enough energy there that some of the energy will drop. The chemical reaction that will occur will drop electrons down orbital, if you will, if you want to think about quantum theory like that, which we do normally, and it will fire off a photon. And that photon is in black body radiation is kind of randomly different frequencies. So you get kind of a broad spectrum. The hotter the item gets, the actual, more blue it gets, if you will. There's more energy being outputted.
And that's why the hotter stars are the ones that are bluer, and the cooler stars are the ones that are more red, if you do astronomy.
Right. And our sun is kind of a black body radiation entity. It's actually a nuclear fusion thing. But basically what we see is that black body radiation. And so that light source is akin to an extremely bright tungsten bulb. Of course, tungsten bulb can't actually get that hot, I don't think. Maybe it can. But in any case, that's very cool. And we moved into fluorescence, which is the gas that's glowing, kind of like a neon light, those tubes, and compact fluorescence, all because of the efficiency of them, not because we like the light source that's coming out of them, but because it's efficient. So if they can do an efficient incandescent, awesome.
Yeah. Now I guess it's about figuring out whether you can actually mass produce these things.
That's true.
And that's always the million-dollar question.
Time will tell, right? Hey, if you'd like to communicate with the show, one way you can do so is just go to Twitter or Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks, all one word. And if you have questions or comments, you can send us a tweet and we will collect them up and respond. And we do all the time. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so reuse our stuff any way you'd like it. Just let them know the geeks say hi. This is independent public radio KOSP 88.9 Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. This is episode 3 of our 16th season. Ben Jaffe and Brian Young, thank you so much for joining me today on GeekSpeak.
Thanks. Thank you.
And thanks to our intern, Chandler, and our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley. And thanks, Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, for our theme song. And thank you for being a part of this episode of GeekSpeak.